Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the first evening of a weekend workshop with Venerable George Chernoff. He'll be with us in about a minute. This is a very exciting workshop. We're going to be looking at the Heart Sutra, and Venerable George will be teaching both this evening from 7 to 9, and then Saturday and Sunday afternoons from 1 to 4. So we hope to see you for all of that. And Venerable George will let us know when he's here.
I'm here.
Okay. Well, welcome.
I thought you saw me. I'm on my screen. Hi. Hello, everyone. Let's see here. There we go. So, maybe this is more technical subject and there will be less people than we had before, but who knows? It's just 7. So why don't we begin with a very short meditation to calm our mind for the clear apprehension of what we're discussing, and also to try to set a motivation. So as we've done before, sit comfortably, relax your body, relax your mind. And as said in many of the sutras after the Buddha, in the prologue, where the Buddha would go into town on alms and he'd come back, he'd wash his feet, he would sit down and place his mindfulness on the respiration in front. So let's do the same. Good example of the Buddha. Just watch your breathing. And if your mind's a little bit relaxed, your breathing has become regular, follow one respiration up as though it's going to the crown of your head, down your central channel to the heart chakra. Leave your attention there. Just watch your mental consciousness. The mental consciousness doesn't present itself to you the same way that the breathing does. That is, you have to look for it. Remind yourself it's not the eye consciousness, not the ear, not the nose, tongue, or tactile consciousness. It's that consciousness within which you dream, you think, you plan, you make decisions, form opinions, have memories of the past, observations of the present, plans about the future. It's that entity within which the positive and negative states of mind arise, the virtuous states of mind, love and compassion, wisdom. Wisdom can be virtuous, and the kleshas, the delusions of anger, attachment, ignorance, all their 84,000 different varieties. Within the mind, try to see the space between thoughts. Hold on to that. Start to develop a mental picture, mental image of the nature of the mind, which is the fact that it is unobstructing. Buddha referred to it as clear light. And clarity is one aspect. The other aspect of the mind is that it perceives, it knows. The space has no shape or color. Consciousness is unobstructing. It's an object that is known by wisdom. You could say it's perceived by the eye of wisdom. Recognizing that, even for an instant, try to develop some satisfaction, rejoicing, pleasant state of mind, and think, with this life I have at present, one of leisure and endowment, I can actually come to understand the nature of the mind, its conventional nature that we're trying to see now, and its ultimate nature, as explained in the Heart Sutra. Motivated out of, first of all, a sense of renunciation for cyclic existence in general, but more properly in the Mahayana setting, motivation of compassion for all living beings, leading to the special thought of bodhicitta, wishing to attain enlightenment as the best means to repay the kindness of all sentient beings, to alleviate their suffering and set them in real Dharma happiness. It's for that purpose, to achieve enlightenment for the sake of sentient beings, that we're going to listen, participate, contemplate, meditate tonight. and the rest of this weekend. This motivation is one of what's called five powers. And with that motivation, bring your attention back to the present. Relax. How's everyone? Okay, good. Like that emoji. Okay. So, last weekend, at the request of Kadampa Center, we discussed the eight verses of Training the Mind, which is one of the seminal texts on developing bodhicitta. We might say the method side of the teachings, skillful means, engaging in activities within the appearance of conventional reality. Tonight we're going to talk about what was alluded to in the last verse of that, the wisdom of emptiness, the wisdom side. So I think in the sutras also Chandrakirti, a famous verse in his Majjhimaka Avatara, he said the method and wisdom are like the two wings of a bird that are necessary to soar into the sky and achieve enlightenment. So one alone doesn't bring you to that goal. And tonight we're going to be speaking of the wing of wisdom. So the vehicle through which we're doing that is the famous Heart Sutra. Prajna Paramita Hridaya. So In a moment or two, I'm going to read through the FPMT English translation of that to set the sequence. But just to give a little background, the Heart Sutra is one of a number of discourses that the Buddha gave on the subject of higher wisdom, the perfection of wisdom, how the bodhisattvas practice that particular perfection. You've heard of the six perfections. The first five perfections, giving, morality, patience, concentration, and enthusiastic perseverance and concentration, these are generally called the method side. In a sense, they are, if devoid of the perfection of wisdom, the sixth perfection, they're a little bit like a blind beggar trying to get somewhere without the eyes to really see how to achieve that goal. They want to get somewhere. Was it the famous story of the blind men and the elephants? They thought it had different shapes. One touched the tail, one touched the legs, one touched the trunk, and so forth. So the Buddha himself taught wisdom in his general teachings to the Shravakas and the Pratika Buddhists, the bhikshus that were with him, as a method to achieve liberation. He taught especially the selflessness of persons. But the Buddha also taught to an exclusive audience on many occasions in which he described the path to full enlightenment, the Mahayana path. And those Mahayana sutras are, many of them are still in existence in Sanskrit, translated into Tibetan, and then obviously into English and so forth. Among those Mahayana sutras, some of them are what are called the sutras on the perfection of wisdom. And the predominant, the most famous of those are what are called the three mothers. So the perfection of wisdom is sometimes called a mother, the mother, because it's the genesis of the matrix, the womb within which the hearers, the solitary realizers, the bodhisattvas practice, and they achieve their individual goals. The shravakas achieve the nirvana of the shravakas. The Pratika Buddhas achieve the nirvana of the Pratika Buddhas. The bodhisattvas achieve full enlightenment. And they have different motivating factors. And so the wisdom is likened to a mother that's common to all of them, but the particular motivating factors, like renunciation and the practices and so forth, are like a father that brings about different lineages. So in India, it was considered, maybe unfairly today, that a child that was born to a mother, maybe a mother had different husbands or consorts at various times, the different children would have the lineage of the father, even though they had the same mother. So they share the same mother. In this case, the Shravakas, the Pratika Buddhas, and the Bodhisattvas share the same mother, perfection of wisdom, but they have different fathers, different motivations. Renunciation in the case of the hearers and Pratika Buddhas, and bodhicitta in the case of the bodhisattvas. So the Buddha taught one extensive discourse at one time that became remembered by the participants as in different ways. Some of them remembered a very short version. It was called the Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 Verses. Others that had a slightly better memory or were more interested in a little more detail remembered it in more detail. It was called the 25,000 Verse Perfection of Wisdom. And those who had prodigious memories, or they liked detail, maybe they they needed to have all of that detail, or they'd like to preserve the teachings in their entirety. That was a exposition that they remembered in 100,000 verses. So those three sutras are called the three mothers, although all of the sutras on the perfection of wisdom are called mother sutras. At least those that explain eight main categories of realizations are called the Mother Sutras. The Heart Sutra is a different occasion than the 100,000, 25,000, and 8,000 verse expositions of the Perfection of Wisdom. It was just one exposition that was remembered in three ways. The Heart Sutra was given at another time, but at the same location, on a mountain outside of Rajgriha. Nowadays people say Rajgir. Have you been? Who's been to Rajgir? I bet some of you have. Yeah, look at all those hands. Okay. Rajgir. Rajagriha. Raja means king. In modern language they say Raj, leading off the final A of Raja, Rajgir. Griha means town or city. So the city of the king, the royal city, What would that be? Maybe that would be Washington, D.C. today. I don't know. Or I'm not sure, New York City, whatever. So outside of that, in the eastern side of the city, there was and is a hilly region, and one particular peak of that is called Vulture's Peak, or more precisely, Massive Vulture's Peak. And it's at that location that the Buddha taught many, if not all, of the perfection of wisdom teachings that he gave. Maybe it's a very, very special place. So this is one of the briefest of the perfection of wisdom sutras. There are a different number, maybe 17 or 11 main ones of perfection of wisdom sutras. This is one of the briefest. There's one that's even briefer that's called the perfection of wisdom in one syllable. If you think this doesn't have many words, compared to the 8,000 verses or 25,000, 100,000 verses, there's a perfection of wisdom in one syllable, but it still has a prologue and an exposition and final dedication at the end. But still, the main discourse was just the syllable ah. In Sanskrit, that's equivalent to our A, right? And you will notice, and maybe you already know, that the syllable A is a negating particle, like what's in English, unknown as opposed to known, or a non-returning, or, you know, different. We have different prefaces in English that refer to negation. The main one, and in Sanskrit there are others like near, ni, but one of the main ones is just the syllable ah. So the sense of that was that phenomena are being negated. The ordinary inherent existence of phenomena are negated with simply enunciating this one syllable. If you wanted to know what the real import of emptiness is. This sutra is longer than that, obviously. The Tibetan of it has, let me see, three pages, a little bit on the fourth page. It is short enough that it is famous in Japan to be on neckties, embossed in neckties or and other kinds of things. The sutra itself that was preserved in Sanskrit and brought down into Tibetan usually has a prologue besides the title, the prologue, and then the actual exposition of the sutra, and then a conclusion. Some of the versions in Chinese and Japanese just have the middle part. And so they're shorter, even shorter than that, but they all essentially are saying the same thing. So I'm going to begin by reading in English the FPMT translation, and then during the talk, when we get to various sections, I'll also recite those sections in Tibetan so that you can say that you received the oral transmission. I've received the oral transmission also. So the title is called The Heart of the Perfection of Wisdom, or The Essence of the Perfection of Wisdom. I prostrate to the Arya Triple Gem. Thus did I hear at one time. The Bhagavan was dwelling on Massive Vulture's Mountain in Rajagriha, together with a great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. At that time, the Bhagavan was absorbed in the concentration on the categories of phenomena called profound perception. Also at that time, the bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara looked upon the very practice of the profound perfection of wisdom and beheld those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature, inherent existence. Then through the power of Buddha, the venerable Shariputra said this to the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara. How should any son of the lineage train who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom? He said that, and the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara said this to the venerable Shariputra. Shariputra, any son of the lineage or daughter of the lineage who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom should look upon it like this, correctly and repeatedly beholding those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Form is empty. Emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form. Form is also not other than emptiness. In the same way, feelings, discriminations, compositional factors, and consciousnesses are empty. Shariputra, likewise, all phenomena are emptiness, without characteristic, unproduced, unceased, stainless, not without stain, not deficient, not fulfilled. Shariputra, therefore, in emptiness, there is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no compositional factors, no consciousness, no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no visual form, no sound, no odor, no taste, no object of touch, and no phenomenon. There is no eye element and so on, up to and including no mind element and no mental consciousness element. There is no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance, and so on, up to and including no aging and death and no extinction of aging and death. Similarly, there is no suffering, origination, cessation, and path. There is no exalted wisdom, no attainment, and also no non-attainment. Shariputra, therefore, because there is no attainment, bodhisattvas rely on and dwell in the perfection of wisdom, the mind without obstruction and without fear, having completely passed beyond error, they reach the end point of nirvana. All the Buddhas who dwell in the three times also manifestly and completely awaken to unsurpassable, perfect, complete enlightenment in reliance on the perfection of wisdom. Therefore, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom, the mantra of great knowledge, the unsurpassed mantra, the mantra that is equal to the unequaled, the mantra that thoroughly pacifies all suffering, should be known as truth, since it is not false. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom is declared, Tadyata gate gate paragate parasamgate bodhi svaha. Shariputra, the Bodhisattva, Mahasattva, should train in the profound perfection of wisdom like that. Then the Bhagavan arose from that concentration and commended the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, saying, well said, son of the lineage. It is like that. It is like that. One should practice the profound perfection of wisdom, just as you have indicated. Even the Tathagatas rejoice. The Bhagavan, having thus spoken, the Venerable Shariputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, and those surrounding in their entirety, along with the world of gods, humans, asuras, and Gandharvas, were overjoyed and highly praised at that spoken by the Bhagavan. Oh, you've heard before, right? At the one of the traditions in the Mahayana teachings is at the beginning of the discourse, there may be some prayers to the Buddha, Shakyamuni, taking of refuge, generating the four immeasurables, and so forth, some other seminal verses, but also usually this Heart Sutra is recited at the beginning. In individual languages, if there are participants of different countries, when the Dalai Lama teaches, he'll have Koreans come up and Vietnamese Sangha come up, and they'll chant the Heart Sutra in their respective languages. Oftentimes it will be recited by some Indian or someone who knows Sanskrit in Sanskrit, and then finally all the Tibetan monks will recite it, and monks and nuns and lay people that know Tibetan will recite it in Tibetan. That is, it is used in that sense to help overcome obstacles to the presentation of the teachings that are going to be given. It's said that the thought, the understanding of that sutra, reciting it alone, even if you don't understand the meaning, and if you do understand the meaning, meditating on that can help to overcome obstacles to the teaching being given. At Sarah, where I lived for a while, but I didn't go that often to the morning prayers. It was said that when in Tibet, the Sarajay Monastery in Tibet, when they recited the Heart Sutra together, they did it in various speeds. The slowest version if any of you have been to Sarah in Tibet, I don't know, outside of Lhasa, is anyone been? A couple of people, okay. If someone left Sarah when the beginning of the prayer was being recited slowly, they could walk all the way into Lhasa and do the circumambulation and come back to Sarah, which is, I don't know, a couple of miles, and the sutra would still be being recited. So they would say it that slowly, meditating on each point. So obviously, to meditate on each point, each word, you have to know the meaning of the word, of the words. So that's what we're going to be talking about tonight and the rest of this weekend. There are different commentaries you can find, some by famous Buddhists, Thich Nhat Hanh or other people. There are ones that are commentaries by lesser known Buddhist teachers of Korea or Japan or so forth. But from the Tibetan point of view, and then there are some that are just written by people who fancy themselves as Buddhists, and they have their own ideas, what the words of the sutra inspire them, and then they even retranslate the sutra in the way that they like to have it. So this weekend, we're not going to be talking about any of those. We're going to be talking about the understanding of the sutra that was in the lineage of the great Indian masters that were closer to the time of the Buddha. So the Buddha lived some 2,500 years ago. Maybe in the sutra, the Mahayana sutras were first re-exposed to the public around the time of Christ, the Common Era. And in the next several hundred years after that, commentaries were written by the Buddhist pundits and practitioners of the time that were, relative to us, they were much closer, even if they were closer to the time of the Buddha, to the oral traditions that explain the meaning of the words. Those are what are often called shastras. The Mahayana shastras. Shastra kind of means, in Tibetan we say tenshe, kind of like the commentaries to them by the great Indian pundits. So, at Kadampa Center, if you've been, there are two sets of scriptures on either side. One set is what's called the Kangyur. Ka is honorific for the proclamation of the Buddha, the speech of the Buddha. Gyur means translation. So those are the actual discourses of the Buddha, the sutras, the Abhidharma, and the Vinaya, and of course the Tantras. And on the other side of the room, also stacked up there, are what are called the Tengyur. Ten is for Tencho or Shastra. So those are the translations of the Shastras. So the commentary that I'm going to be going by is based on several of those that are found in that collection. Although I have my own ignorance as will filter out some of the good points, and my own predispositions or my own likings will favor certain ideas, so it may not be in accord with all of those. There were maybe half dozen or a dozen shastras that were commentaries, some of which still exist. And then later on, Tibetans wrote commentaries on the Heart Sutra. So we're going to be basing a little bit on that. Okay? So, how are you doing? You okay? A little bit verbose here. So, at the beginning, there is an explanation of the title. You might say, why? We know what that's supposed to be. And sometimes people, you know, there's even commentary of why there's a title. Some of the sort of seemingly absurd reasons why there's a title given is so that you'll know what text you're reading. Well, that's true, actually. If you go to your bookshelf and you want to get a book, you have to look the titles written on the side, right? Otherwise, if it's not there, you can't find it very easily, or there's no indication. If all the books look the same, you have to look through all of them for a long time. So the sutra on the essence of the Bhagavati, perfection of wisdom. So Bhagavati, I mentioned during the recitation of the sutra the word Bhagavan. Do you know what Bhagavan means? There was maybe some of you are the same era of I remember Bhagwan Rajneesh. Bhagwan in modern Hindi, where they instead of van, they have wan. Bhagwan or Bhagavan means Lord, or someone who has great auspicious qualities. They say something like six great auspicious qualities. But the Buddha, one of the epithets of the Buddha himself, of the Buddhas of the three times, is they call the Buddhas Bhagavan, Bhagavan. And the commentaries that came from the great Indian pundits have an etymology of that that's different than how people often think of it. It's the words that we sometimes say in Tibetan, Chom Dende. Chom means to destroy. Den means having, endowed with certain qualities. So destroyed some bad things, endowed with other things. And De means transcendent, super mundane. So the Buddha himself is called the Bhagavan, and the Prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom, is also called the Bhagavan, but in the feminine tense. So Bhagavati, instead of Bhagavat or Bhagavan, Bhagavati. So the sense of that is, as I said before, the perfection of wisdom that the Buddha, the actual perfection of wisdom that the Buddha, the omniscient mind has, is the wisdom that allows the Buddha to teach all of the various disciples and gives rise to the three classes, the Shravakas, the Pratyeka Buddhas, and the Bodhisattvas. It's kind of the mother. So the word Bhagavati doesn't mean mother, but it's the feminine tense of it, kind of, one could take it to mean the feminine, the feminine transcendent destroyer, endowed transcendent destroyer. So I shouldn't look at the book because there's so many other things there. So when we talk about the title, I'll say just in this case, it, the Tibetan says, Gyakar Kedu. That means in the language of India, which is referring to Sanskrit. There are many languages at the time of the Buddha in India, but here it's talking about Sanskrit rather than Pali or some of the other languages. Bhagavati Prajna Paramita Hridaya. So Bhagavati is referring to, is giving a title to the Prajna Paramita, the perfection of wisdom, as though it is the, it itself, that state of mind, is able to destroy all of the opposing forces, to destroy the two obstructions. Sometimes in some of the commentaries they say it refers to the destruction of the five maras. You've heard of the five maras, right? Hridaya at the end means heart, like we call the Heart Sutra, or it can also mean, as heart also means the essence. So the essence of the Bhagavati perfection of wisdom. Pukedu, that means in Tibetan, in the language of Tibet. Chomden Dema, Sherab Giparu Tu Chimpe, Ningbo. Ningbo again means heart or essence. And the Tibetan text, as was traditional in Tibet, when Mahayana sutras were written, they were divided up into sections that are called bampos. And this is, it just says Bampo Chinko, the first Bampo. So then it begins, Dike Daki Tuba Tuchikna, or in our English translation, thus did I hear at one time. So that is the same initial prologue that one finds in all of the sutras, whether they be from the Pali Canon, the Hinayana Sutras, or the Mahayana Sutras. They all begin in that way. And it refers to the compiler of that sutra, the person who, in this case, in the Hinayana Sutras is always Ananda, who heard the teachings either directly or indirectly. That is to say, indirectly, if he was not present, if some of the sutras were given before Ananda came, he was either blessed by the Buddha to have the understanding of it, having heard it, or he heard it from others who heard those sutras. But after Ananda became the attendant of the Buddha, he heard all of those sutras. Okay? So the Mahayana Sutras, though, Ananda is not mentioned as one of the participants here. There were a great number of monks, Shravakas and so forth, that were there. Ananda might have been there, but usually the Mahayana Sutras, after the demise of Buddha, after the Buddha passed into parinirvana, the the sutras were re-spoken by Ananda afterwards, so that all of the monks who had not heard all of the sutras would have a common understanding of what the Buddha's teachings were. The Mahayana sutras were given to a different audience. They weren't given to mainly to the Shravakas and Pratika Buddha practitioners, but mainly to the Bodhisattvas or aspiring Bodhisattvas, those who had a deeper understanding of the meaning of the teachings. They had generally greater inspiration because they were motivated out of bodhicitta. Dike Daki Topa Tuchikna. Thus did I hear at one time. So this can be referring to perhaps the Bodhisattva Manjushri, who is said to have recited the Mahayana Sutras afterwards at a different occasion, mainly for the Bodhisattvas. It might have been one of the other Bodhisattvas at the time, sometimes mentioned the Bodhisattva Maitreya, but that when it says, thus did I hear at one time, that's referring to a particular, to the occasion of that sutra, that they actually were present at that time, or they heard it through another person who was there. Okay. So then the sutra continues, the Bhagavan was dwelling on massive Vultures Mountain in Rajagriha together with a great community of monks and a great community of Bodhisattvas. So here, when it's talking about a great community of monks, that's often what one has at the beginning of the Hinayana Sutras. It will sometimes at the beginning of the Buddha's teachings, there were a small group of monks, and that group of monks became larger and larger. I think turn this down. People are sending me messages just when I'm talking. Sometimes 1,750 or some other number of monks, bhikshus. Here when it says a great community of monks, it's calling the word sangha, a great sangha of bhikshus. So that's referring to a large number of them who were there. They may not have been the main listeners of the teachings, but perhaps because of this very special occasion, the Buddha had invited them. The main participants were the community of Bodhisattvas, together with a great community of monks and a great community of Bodhisattvas. So great community means Mahasangha, great group. Of the Bodhisattvas. So these were probably including the eight great Bodhisattvas. Do you know the eight great Bodhisattvas? Some of the ones that you know are Avalokiteshvara and Manjushri, Vajrapani. They were actually living embodiments, perhaps of either emanations of the Buddha that had the same names of the meditational deities. Maitreya, who would be the future Buddha, whose mind stream then was manifesting as one of the Bodhisattvas. Samantabhadra, Bodhisattva Samantabhadra. Akashagarbha. Skitigarbha. In the Chinese tradition, one of the famous, especially important to the Chinese tradition. And then Sarva Nivarana Vishkambini, which I always find amusing. The other ones had short names, like Vajrapani, Manjushri, Avalokiteshvara. So Sarva Nivarana Vishkambini. I could just imagine his mother calling out, Sarva Nivarana Vishkambini, come home for dinner. Sarva means all, Nivarana means obstructions. Sarva Nivarana. Vishkambini means who is eliminated all of the obstructions. It's interesting, in some of the prayers that you find, even in the tantric sadhanas, there are prayers where there's a whole bunch of referring to a certain group of deities or something with short names, and then there's one group that might have a very, very long name, kind of like this, you know? So, the Buddha was, the Bhagavan, referring to the Buddha, was dwelling on massive Vulture's Mountain, Vulture's Peak, in Rajagriha, means to the, as I say, to the east of Rajagriha, together with a great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. This is what's called the common prologue. It's common to almost all of the sutras. At that time, let me say in Tibetan. I said before, Dike Daki Tuba Tuchikna. That's what I've heard it one time. Chom Dende Gelpo Kap Chago Pumpo Rila Gelongi Gendun Chempodang Jangshub Sempe Gendun Chempodang Tap Chiktu Shukte. Tap Chiktu means seated together, or seated in the same way. How did we translate here? Was dwelling on masses, Vulture's Mountain in Rajagriha, together with a great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. Sometimes the Tibetan Tap Chiktu means they were all in the same aspect, that they were respectful, sitting either in meditation posture or standing. Also, the idea of Rajagriha, of Vulture's Peak rather, is one of the etymology, reasons for that mountain to be called that. It said that the bodhisattvas who were listening, some of them were highly realized, had psychic powers, because if you've been to Vulture's Peak, you know it's very, very cramped. I don't know, bigger than my loft here, which you can't see, but it's, you know, it's like a couple hundred feet. There's not a lot of room, and then you're down on the sides. So some of the bodhisattvas with psychic powers were actually hovering in space, sort of like vultures. And that mountain also sometimes, one could see from the distance what appeared to be vultures circling around the peak. That's supposedly why it was called that, Vulture's Peak. So, they were seated together, Tap Chiktu, which in Tibetan means kind of in the same way. And it's not reflected so much in the English translation. Sometimes that's not mentioned, distinguished off so much. So then the uncommon prologue. At that time, so when the Buddha's there, the Bhagavan was absorbed in the concentration on the categories of phenomena called profound perception. So the Buddha's not really participating verbally in this. It's understood that the Buddha is omniscient. He knows what's happening. In fact, he's inspiring the conversation that's going to be taking place between Shariputra and Arya Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva. But he is actually in a meditative concentration, a samadhi, single-pointed concentration on the categories of phenomena. And that concentration is called perception of the profound, or profound perception. So the sense of this is that this particular samadhi, there are many kinds of samadhi, single-pointed concentrations that the bodhisattvas have and the Buddhas have. This particular concentration is one that's exclusive to the Buddhas, because its object, one of the objects that it's perceiving is the varieties of phenomena, not just emptiness. It's perceiving all phenomena, conventional phenomena, trees, fences, walls, persons, you know, all sorts of things, all the varieties of phenomena. But it is also knowing them at the same time directly as empty of inherent existence. It is a samadhi called perception of the profound, or profound perception on the enumeration of phenomena, all of the different kinds of phenomena. So it implies by that the Buddha was engaging in that particular quality that only the omniscient mind has, perceiving the two levels of truth at the same time, conventional truth and ultimate truth. Right? Do you know, have you heard of the two truths? Anyone who hasn't heard of the two truths? I didn't say two truths. You probably have heard in the news the last days, there's the new phrase that maybe one comedian or some commentator came out with at the time now, with all of the assertions of certain people in the world today, they're calling truth decay. There it's actually, instead of tooth decay, it's truth decay. I'm talking about the two truths, not the two tooths or two teeth. So the Buddha said that all phenomena in their entirety are either conventional truths or ultimate truths. Conventional truths or ultimate truths, right? The word that we use for, that's translated as conventional truth in Sanskrit is samvritti satya. Samvritti has different etymologies. Sometimes it means conventional, sometimes it means designated, sometimes it means a veiled truth. So the Tibetan etymology of that, there are three different translations of that same word in Tibetan for those three different kind of meanings of conventional truth. We can say conventional, designated, or imputed, or hidden, or veiled. So that one is it means it's truth for a mind that is still encumbered by ignorance. So Jeffrey Hopkins, many years ago, you know, you've heard of Jeffrey Hopkins, really one of the great translators. He encapsulated that when he taught once in Bodh Gaya. He called it truth for a jerk. So now I'm not saying what political affiliation I have, but some of you might say some of the things that people are saying are true today are actually just true for a jerk. Do you get the meaning? You know, it said like truth for an imbecile. Anyone that had any sense wouldn't think of them as truth. So that's kind of the sense here. Conventional truths are those things that we perceive. I'm looking at a heater right in front of me, or, you know, it could be the wall or reflection of myself or water, tea, whatever. Conventional phenomena that appear to us as actually existing, they're findable somehow within their parts. They are actually devoid of that reality that we're attributing to them. It's not that we just make something else up and we attribute it to it, but to those phenomena, but they actually appear that way. As soon as we give a name to something, my heater, my iPad, my this or that, or, you know, tea or fence or tree, as soon as we give the name, we perceive something and we're either told its name or we remember its name. It appears that phenomena is existing, that is almost the thing that we're naming is actually existing there from its own side, inherently, without depending on anything else. phenomena that are perceived in that way are what are called conventional truths. Ultimate truths are the way in which all of these phenomena actually exist. They're actually empty of the existence that our mind is, the existence is appearing to our senses and that our mind accedes to, our mind adheres to, our mind agrees with. We call it grasping to inherent existence, grasping a true existence. That grasping doesn't mean simply perceiving it, but it means going along with it. What's the word? Did I say accede? When in a debate, I'm not using the right word. What's the word when you don't really have a strong opinion one way or the other, but you're going to go along with something? Isn't that acceding? What am I trying to say? Who knows?
Exceeding, yeah.
Not exceeding.
Acceding to it, yeah.
Acceding, yeah. So the two levels of truth, conventional truth, or you say Jeffrey Kahn says truth for a jerk, or in the Tibetan, Kunsob Denpa means truth for a concealing mind, a mind that is still under the influence of delusions. Main delusion is the grasping the mind that is holding that phenomena do exist the way that they appear as findable. Okay, so the two truths. So the samadhi that the Buddha, the Bhagavan, is in equipoise on is one that is perceiving the two levels of truth at the same time. We, ordinary beings, even bodhisattvas, higher bodhisattvas, cannot perceive the two levels of truth directly at the same time. They're, when they perceive emptiness directly, they're in meditative equipoise. Nothing else appears to their mind, no conventional phenomena, no trees, no fences, no person, no goal. Nothing appears to their mind except just the negation of inherent existence, just emptiness, space-like emptiness. When they arise from that, they see phenomena again. They see conventionalities. If they've realized emptiness directly, they're no longer called conventional truths. They're called conventionalities because they don't believe them. They see them like illusions. But even though they know the phenomena that are appearing to be inherently existent are devoid of that, they know that they are not existing that way. They're like illusions, you know, like dreams or reflections, echoes, and so forth. Still, they're not directly realizing emptiness. They're remembering emptiness, the direct realization of emptiness that they had. They have a subsequent cognition of that. So even the 10th level bodhisattvas, like Arya Avalokiteshvara, who we'll mention in a second, even they do not perceive the two levels of truth at the same time directly. Whereas the Buddha is in this particular samadhi that's exclusive, the Bhagavan's in this exclusive samadhi concentration, only the Buddhas have, in which he is perceiving emptiness directly and the varieties of phenomena, the conventional phenomena, at the same time. A little bit like in Tantra, when one tries to recognize if one arises as a deity, one tries to recognize all the appearances within that that have a conventional appearance as empty of inherent existence. One is practicing that, trying to bring that into the present. But here the Buddha is actually in that particular samadhi. And as a result of that samadhi, his concentration, he is blessing the mind of Shariputra, who we're going to mention in a second, and the mind of Avadhuk Yajneshvara. He's kind of setting up the situation that these two individuals are going to have a conversation about what he wants to be talked about. This is often the case in the sutras. There are some sutras that are actually from the Buddha's holy mouth, his speech, actual speech of the Buddha, and there are others that are inspired by the power of the Buddha. And this is one of those. You can be inspired by various things. Here it's inspired by his concentration. So at that time, the Bhagavan was absorbed in the concentration on the categories of phenomena, or you say the varieties of phenomena, called profound perception. Also at that time, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, Arya Avalokiteshvara, long title, right? Sometimes you hear Arya Avalokiteshvara. Maybe you just hear Avalokiteshvara, the Buddha of compassion, right? Here we're talking about the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. He was an Arya being. That means someone who has realized emptiness directly. At that point, you're no longer an ordinary being because you perceive the way that phenomena actually exist. You're a superior being, an Arya being. And he was a Bodhisattva Mahasattva. He's the person that's going to be the main expositor of the Heart Sutra. So you know what the word Bodhisattva means, right? Do you know what a Mahasattva is? Susie knows. Go on. Unmute yourself.
There. Is it the highest? Is it the highest?
Oh, you'd think so, because Maha means great, right?
I thought it meant the great one, yeah.
Yeah. So, well, Mahasattva is another word that is used for bodhisattvas. So the conundrum in the commentaries, why does he mention it twice? Why does he say, if Mahasattva means bodhisattva, why does he say both bodhisattva and also Mahasattva? Well, one of the most illuminating, sort of meaningful explanations of that is that when we say, both words end in sattva, right? Bodhisattva, Mahasattva. Sattva means can mean sentient being. It's the actual word that we translate as sentient being. But generally, it also means courageous, or as the Tibetans translated in Tibetan, sempa, courageous mind. So bodhisattva would mean the person whose mind is courageous toward bodhi. Right? So that's one part of the meaning of bodhicitta, right? Bodhicitta is a special primary mental consciousness that is acts as a doorway to the Mahayana path that takes as its goal bodhi, enlightenment, out of the motivation of compassion for all sentient beings. So when you use the name bodhisattva for that individual, it's emphasizing his or her aim to achieve bodhi. I'm going to put my finger here so you can see it, otherwise you don't know where I'm pointing, to bodhi. A mahasattva, on the other hand, is emphasizing the other aspect of bodhicitta, which is out of the motivation for the benefit of all sentient beings. Like when we talk about the Mahayana, the great vehicle. It's called the great vehicle because it gets you to the great destination, Mahayana, the great destination, and also because it's big. It takes all sentient beings to that goal. It's not just taking you, the Shravaka or Pratyeka Buddha, to your own great destination of nirvana, but it's taking to the ultimate great destination of enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. So it's maha in that way, right? So it said that when the two words are used in conjunction like that, it's kind of reminding one of both aspects, that Arya Avalokiteshvara was a bodhisattva aiming for enlightenment out of the motivation to achieve the state of omniscience, to bring all sentient beings, the maha, the masses, all sentient beings, into that same state. Make sense? Let me take a sip. So, also at that time, so it means at the same time the Buddha's in this samadhi that's exclusive to the Buddha's, where he's perceiving emptiness, but also all phenomena appearing to his mind at the same time, directly. At that time, the Bodhisattva Mahasasa, Avalokiteshvara, looked upon the very practice of the profound perfection of wisdom. He was not in direct realization of emptiness. He had, being an Arya being, he's realized emptiness previously, but now he's in post-meditation, and he's contemplating the practice of the profound perfection of wisdom, how the bodhisattvas practice these six perfections. Or if you elaborate more extensively, the 10 perfections, how the bodhisattvas practice. He looked upon the very practice of the profound perfection of wisdom and beheld those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature, inherent existence. So he's thinking about how the bodhisattvas practice the perfection of wisdom, which is not simply to recognize the emptiness of the self, you know, your own, you know, personal selflessness, or the selflessness of other persons, but also the emptiness of all phenomena. You know, you may remember that in the Hinayana teachings, the wisdom that brings about their goal of nirvana generally takes as its main object of investigation the self-identity. When we talk about the realization of emptiness from their point of view, the word emptiness generally doesn't appear in the Hinayana Sutras. When it does, it's referring to a more general meaning of emptiness, like the temple is empty of monks. It is when the monks are somewhere else. So something that was once there and at present is not there. But when we talk about emptiness in the Mahayana, Mahayana Sutras, the meaning of emptiness is much more profound than that. It means that phenomena are empty of that which we imagine is in them, some kind of inherent existence. So he says that he beheld the five aggregates also, or the text says, he beheld those five aggregates also as empty of inherent existence, inherent nature. So what that means is the person who's going to be asking him the questions, Shariputra, is a Shravaka. His main investigation is the selflessness of persons. He perceives that there's no self of persons existing inherently, but he thinks that the aggregates, at least according to their tenets, the basis for imputing the person, what's the basis? On which basis do you call someone a person? Well, their form, their feelings, their discriminations, their compositional factors, and their consciousness, right? Five aggregates. Have you heard of the five aggregates? Five skandhas? Pancha skanda. skanda or aggregates or heaps. Well, like this, if you were to take apart your, I don't know, Donna, what kind of car do you have?
Prius.
Prius. If you take apart Donna's Prius, you put all of the steel or iron in one pile. You take it apart. All of the rubber, like the wheels and the vinyl, in another pile. All the glass from the windows in another pile. All of the petroleum and oil in another pile. You have different piles, heaps or skandhas that you can divide it into, right? And afterwards, when you've taken completely apart, there's nothing left. So you might think the Prius is somewhere there in those five piles, or those whatever number of piles you decide to divide it up into, right? How finely you could divide it into many, many kind of piles. So if you look, you can't find the Prius anywhere there. I joke with the people in Singapore, who a lot of them have Mercedes, the wealthy people. They might think that the Mercedes is in that little medallion, or the, you know, oh, that's the, you know, where's the Mercedes? It's not the tires. That's the, oh, but that's the, you know, you can't find it anywhere there. But so it's as though the Prius now has a kind of existence that you were had not really thought of before. You thought somehow the Prius was there. When you investigate, you can't find the Prius in any of the parts. So a similar kind of analysis in the selflessness of persons. You look for the person that is a sort of a, you're assuming exists, because it seems there seems to be an appearance in your mind that's very difficult to ascertain of your own personal identity, not just as a dentist or a doctor or a teacher or a mom or a dad or, you know, whatever, but me, meanness, selfness. When you recognize that it is not anywhere in the parts of the body, the five aggregates, like the parts of the Prius, and it doesn't exist elsewhere, you might think, oh, well, the soul, the self exists independent of the aggregates. And when you analyze in the correct way, you see that that is not the case, because if someone were to stick you in the hand with a needle, you would immediately think, I've been stuck. You know, I've been stung or whatever, maybe a bee. So the self is not something that exists separate from the aggregates, and it's not part of, it can't be found in the aggregates, and they recognize the selflessness of persons, that the person doesn't exist in the way that our mind has up until that point believed. How they understand the person as conventionally existent comes afterwards, but it's the person is selfless without such an inherently existent self. But they believe that the basis to designate that person, the aggregates, the body, the feelings, discriminations, compositional factors, and primary consciousnesses, they exist. You know, there's the body. You know, like the Prius, you know, there's the pile of rubber. You can't find the Prius, but there's the pile of rubber. There's a pile of glass, the puddle of petroleum rather than pile. All of these different heaps, they exist. Whereas in the Mahayana, the perfection of wisdom, it's understood that selflessness applies not only to the person, but to all phenomena. We talk about the selflessness of persons and the selflessness of phenomena. Hence, he says, or the expositor is saying, Avalokiteshvara looked upon the very practice of the profound perfection of wisdom, He was kind of thinking about that and beheld those five aggregates. That means the five aggregates that Shariputra and the other Hinayana practitioners took as their the basis upon which the person is designated, that they believed that, you know, they understand the person is not existing the way that it appears. Like, you can't find the Prius in the parts. You can't find the person in the aggregates. Yet they believe that the aggregates themselves are inherently existent. Does that make sense? You've heard this before, some of you, right? He looked upon the very practice of the profound perfection of wisdom and beheld those five aggregates also, important word, also as empty of inherent nature. So the implication is that Shariputra, the other Hinayana practitioners, understood the self of persons. The self is empty of inherent existence, but they still have this, they haven't really delved into the emptiness of the basis of designating the person, the five aggregates. There is a still clinging to that, to those aggregates as inherently existent, whereas Avalokiteshvara beheld those five aggregates also as empty of inherent existence. Yes, Susie.
So is there only one thing that they think is selfless, the self?
So it's a big philosophical debate. In the Hinayana Sutras, let's say as today, as we talk about the Pali Canon that we would generally associate with Theravada Buddhism, right? The main theoretical exposition is that there is, the person is selfless. There is a selflessness of persons. Phenomena other than the person, he or herself, him or herself, are, say, the bases for imputing them and other phenomena are also said to be selfless, but in a different way. They are selfless in the sense, when you talk about the selflessness of phenomena in the Pali Canon, generally it means that the other things, like my tea, is not an object to be enjoyed by an inherently existent person or a self-supporting, substantially existent person. They're not objects of use or perception or enjoyment by a substantially existent person. Therefore, they are, that fact that they can't be enjoyed by an inherently existent person or a substantially existent person, that fact is referred to as the selflessness of phenomena. So it's kind of like they still inherently exist, but because they're not capable of being enjoyed or perceived or utilized by a substantially existent person, because such a person doesn't exist, therefore they are said, that is said to be the selflessness of phenomena. That's what
I just find that kind of tortured, you know, like they really went out of their way to miss it, the point, you know?
Well, yeah. So that is how in the treatises, the commentaries in the Hinayana and in the actual tradition, what's usually meant by the selflessness of phenomena. So generally the main thing, the selflessness of persons means the person doesn't exist the way that it appears, but that the other phenomena upon which the person is dependent in terms of the designation of the person and in terms of objects of enjoyment and utilization and so forth, they do, they have a status that is real, inherently existent. Whereas Lama Tsongkhapa and starting with Nagarjuna and the great expositors of the Buddhist teachings on emptiness said that In order to actually achieve nirvana, the Hinayana practitioners have to realize the actual lack of inherent existence of other phenomena. So the Shravakas do realize the full meaning of emptiness, not just the selflessness of persons, not the superficial meaning of the selflessness of phenomena. They eventually realize, in order to achieve nirvana, they have to realize the emptiness of inherent existence of other phenomena. So there's a bit of a disjoint here. How is it in their treatises this is not explained? Well, it is explained in some passages, but in a very almost subtle way. There's a famous, let's see if I can find here, famous passage. That is found in the Hinayana, in some of the suttas in the Pali Canon. Goes a little bit like this. If I can find it here. I put yellow marker on it here so I could... No, I can't find it. Anyway, it's something like this. It says that the... Oh, I thought I'd find it after I said I can't find it. Okay, it's something to the effect that forms are like balls of foam. Feelings are like bubbles. Discriminations are like the plantain tree, like a banana tree, or is also translated in some of them like the root of a lotus. So if you, or the stalk of a lotus, if you take it apart at the end, there's nothing there. If you take apart a banana tree, all the leaves at the end, there's nothing there. So, though the illusion, the Buddha referred to the aggregates in these ways as sort of like a subtle indication to those who were really delving into selflessness that all phenomena were also empty of inherent existence, but it's not explicitly stated. Yeah, Miss Diana Abramo. Diana. You have to unmute yourself first.
I want to ask a question, but I leave it entirely to you whether this would be a distraction and not to be answered right now. It makes complete sense to me to say that the difference between the Hinayana or Theravada practitioner and the Mahayana practitioner is the ultimate goal. And in particular, whether the goal is to bring all sentient beings with you or to focus primarily on your own arrival at nirvana. That's definitional to me. Is there a fundamental reason that to be a Hinayana practitioner, which is to say to have this other ultimate goal, is accompanied by a perception of some existence, some self-existence of non-self objects, of the objects of perception? Does the one necessarily imply the other, or is it just a historical thing?
Well, it has to be there's a lot of different elements that come into this. So let me say again, what you said about the motivation is generally how we distinguish between the Shravakas, the Pratika Buddhas on one hand, Hinayana practitioners, and the Bodhisattvas on the other hand. They have the same mother, it is said, the perfection of wisdom. So the implication is that even the Hinayana practitioners do realize eventually, if they achieve their goal, they do realize the emptiness of phenomena in the sense that the Mahayana is propounding, that phenomena themselves, the body, the aggregates, other phenomena outside the mind, everything, also are empty of inherent existence. They appear to be to the mind as having some findable existence, but when you search within their parts, you can't. But if you look in the Pali Canon, you find only some allusions to that deeper meaning of emptiness in the Pali Canon. So the implication seems to be that it was something that those who were actually going to achieve that goal of nirvana, they're mainly meditating on the selflessness of the persons, either they would encounter teachers along the way that would instruct them into the fact that other phenomena were also like the person, empty of inherent existence, or they would be through the blessings of the Buddha, they would reinterpret those verses that they had understood more superficially before and realize that. But in general, they don't have many reasonings to establish emptiness. It's said that one of the big differences between the bodhisattvas and the practitioners of the lesser vehicle in terms of realizing emptiness, they realize the same emptiness, but the bodhisattvas, because they have made a vow, an aspiration to remain in samsara as long as it takes to benefit sentient beings, they need a great number, a multitude of reasonings to establish emptiness in different contexts. The emptiness of coming and going, the emptiness of the 12 links, the emptiness of this, like in Nagarjuna's Fundamental Wisdom, each of the chapters of that is talking about the emptiness of another phenomena, like the emptiness of the four truths or the emptiness of the 12 links and so forth. There are certain chapters that His Holiness the Dalai Lama has suggested, rather than 24 chapters or whatever, rather than teaching all of them, he said at this time, these ones are the essential ones. So the bodhisattvas have to have a quick mind to apply emptiness to all sorts of situations to overcome the reluctance, you know, I'm not sure if I talked about it in the 8 verses last time or in the 37 practices in Washington and New York, but one of the obstacles to perseverance is a kind of laziness that comes about from feeling the goal is like, oh my gosh, how could I achieve this? How could I work for the benefit of all sentient beings? It's just like too enormous. And another kind of a feeling of low self-esteem, thinking, I just don't have what it takes. Yeah, sort of low self-esteem. So they have to apply emptiness in situations like that too, just to understand to how to keep on persevering in the path. They need to apply emptiness in all sorts of situations. So that's one of the main differences from Nagarjuna's point of view and Lama Tsongkhapa's point of view between the Hinayana practitioners, the practitioners of the lesser vehicle, and the Mahayana. The Mahayana, they have different goals. They have different motivations. The Hinayana practitioner is motivated by renunciation of samsara, wants to get out, has compassion, even in their point of view, great compassion, but not the will to remain for so long in samsara to achieve the goal. And the Mahayana does have that, the motivation of bodhicitta to achieve enlightenment for the sake of souls. All sentient beings, which may take an enormous amount of time. So they have to have a much sharper mind with many reasonings. So for those various reasons, in the Pali Canon, you don't find a explicit, detailed explanation of many reasonings. It's sort of like just in a nutshell. It's enough for them to realize the selflessness of persons authentically. They could realize that the person is empty of an inherently existent person. Okay? There was someone else who was, Stephanie, you have a question?
I think mine's a little simpler. Do you think that, is it understood that at this time, was this the first time when Avalokiteshvara had the realization of the emptiness of all phenomenon, or had he already realized that? Or was he,
he's called Arya Avalokiteshvara.
Yes.
As a Bodhisattva, Mahasattva just means that he's developed bodhicitta. But Arya means he's realized emptiness directly before. So generally, Avalokiteshvara doesn't appear in, I'm not sure if it occurs in any of the Prajnaparamita Sutras other than the Heart Sutra. Generally, it's other of the Bodhisattvas that are appearing in them. He appears in some of the other sutras, and he is known as one of the great eight Bodhisattvas at the time of the Buddha, but he has definitely realized emptiness because he's referred to as Arya Avalokiteshvara. Arya means the superior being who's realized it. So he's just, at this point, inspired by the Buddha's presence and samadhi. He is inspired to be thinking about this, about the perfection of wisdom, and the fact that as opposed to the general doctrine of the Hinayana teachings, the Pali Canon, that the Buddha has taught himself, mainly emphasizing on the selflessness of persons, that the basis for imputing the person, the five aggregates, is also empty of inherent existence. He beheld those five aggregates also as empty of inherent existence, inherent nature. Okay? So let me say the Tibetan of that for auspiciousness, so you kind of get the Tibetan transmission also. Yang de se, that means also at that time. Jangshub sempa, sempa chempo. Pakpa chenrezi, wangchuk. Sherab gi parul tu chimpa sabmo chupa nila, nampar tao. Also at that time, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, Arya Avalokiteshvara, beheld the practice, looked upon the practice of the profound perfection of wisdom. So he's thinking about how the Bodhisattvas practice wisdom, and he beheld those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Pumpo ngapo, that means those, pumpo ngapo dedakla, to those five aggregates. Yang also, rangshingi tongpar nampar tao. He also beheld those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Okay, we're together? Someone else have a question? Okay. So you're welcome to, okay. Then, through the power of Buddha, the venerable, so this is implying, the Buddha's in this meditative equipoise. So rather than telling Shariputra, hey, Shariputra, ask this question, or something like that, you know, he says, through the power of Buddha, the inspiration of Buddha, the Venerable Shariputra said this to the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara. So Shariputra's mother was named Shari. Putra means son, right? The son of Shari. His father's name was Tisa, so sometimes in the sutras, when Shariputra is first, when talking about how he first was introduced to the Buddha, he's referred to as Upatissa, so coming after Tissa. Thetis his father, but Shari is his mother, who is said to be the brightest woman. There are so many women here, I can't choose who's brightest. All of you are bright. So if you have a child, they would be called Diana Putra or Karen Putra, Susie Putra, Julie Putra, whatever. And sometimes they might take your husband's name or your, you know, the father of that child's name, like he's also called Upatissa. So here he's called Shariputra. Then through the power of the Buddha, the venerable Shariputra said the following to the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Avalokiteshvara. How should any son of the lineage train who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom? So this is a little bit enigmatic, because of the Buddha's disciples, the Hinayana disciples, disciples of the lesser vehicle, Shravakas and Pratihubas, Shariputra was said to be foremost in wisdom. I think I might have mentioned this before. At the time of the Buddha, I'm not sure, you know, what reason, but the Buddha mentioned almost everyone that they were foremost in something. You know, Mahamoggallana, one of the Buddha's main disciples, was foremost in psychic powers, emanations and magical things. Shariputra was foremost of all the disciples, the best in wisdom. Mahakashyapa, one of the Buddha's first disciples, was foremost in ascetic practices. Mahakashyapa was the one that Buddha gave his original robe to. You know, when the Buddha was meditating for 6 years with his five close companions, you know the story, right? Meditated, lived on, eventually just a jujube per day, became emaciated, the famous statue of the fasting Buddha. You know, you see his bones and everything, emaciated. At that time, when he went to wash himself in a pond, he almost drowned in the pond. He was so weak because he had not been taking care of himself. And a servant came. She was bringing the corpse of the mother of the family. She was the servant of the family. She was bringing the grandmother or the whatever to either to a charnel ground or to a cremation. And she was she had an offering to make to the gods, which was made with milk and rice and so forth. They would milk 100 cows, and that milk they would feed to 99 cows. And then the milk of those 99 cows, which is like a little richer because they've been drinking milk, right, was fed to 98 cows. And so finally, then the milk of the final cow is like super rich, right? Supposedly. I don't know. Does that happen? Any of you who are in horticulture? I imagine it might be. Anyway, they believe that. And so this was a special offering that we were going to make to the gods, to the Nagas or whatever. But she saw the Buddha, the Buddha-to-be, he's not yet sat under the Bodhi tree, he's done his 6 years of retreat, emaciated, weak. She fed that to him, and he decided to follow a middle way between asceticism and, you know, like the life he had led previously as a prince, sort of wanton abandonment. Also at that time, she gave the Buddha the shroud that was around the grandmother, the burial shroud, which was made of, because you don't need to make it out of expensive things. It's just going to be either burned in the cremation or in the charnel ground. It's very, very coarse and, you know, sticky, you know, things sticking into your skin. She gave that shroud to the Buddha, and he used that then as his robe when he sat under the Bodhi tree and for years afterwards, until he bestowed it upon Mahakashyapa, the disciple who we thought was foremost in ascetic practices. There were what are called the 13 great ascetic practices. And so Mahakashapya wore this, even though it was, you know, it was painful. It was the Buddha's robe. Hey, man, this is the robe he wore under the Bodhi tree. Of course he's going to wear this. And so different people were said to be foremost in different qualities. So Shariputra was foremost in wisdom. So it's kind of ironic here that he's asking Avalokiteshvara, how did the bodhisattvas train who want to practice the perfection of wisdom? How should any son of the lineage train who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom? And another aside here, how should any son of the lineage, almost the implication here is that in the Theravada tradition, it was believed that in order to achieve enlightenment, you had to achieve enlightenment, that final life, you had to be a fully ordained monk, bhikshu, a son of the lineage. Whereas in the Mahayana, like today, it's understood that it doesn't depend on the physical form that you have, but the mind, so that male and female are exactly equal in their ability. So in his answer in a minute, Avalokiteshvara is going to say, any son of the lineage or daughter of the lineage who wants to train should do like this, sort of like more enlightened attitude, right? Then through the power of the Buddha, the Venerable Shariputra said this to the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara. How should any son of the lineage train who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom? Dene Sange Gitu, then by the power of Buddha, Sedan Dempa, Sharipu, Jangshup Sempa, Sempa Chempo, Pakpa Chenrezi, Wangchuk La, to Shariputra, to Avalokiteshvara, DK Che Mas Meso, said this. Rikipu. Kanglala, to whatever son of the lineage, Sherab Kiparo tu Chimpa Sabmo Chopa Chepa Dopate, Chita Laparja. How should any son of the lineage who wishes to train in the practice of the profound perfection of wisdom, train, who wishes to practice the activity. So there's three words, training, practice, activity. So I'll give you a short answer here and then we'll stop for tonight. We've got Saturday and Sunday to contend. So he said that, and then he said that, and the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara said this to the Venerable Shariputra. So here in the Sanskrit, it gives the name with an extra syllable. Instead of saying Shariputra, it says Sharadvati Putra. I'm not sure if that's a longer version of Shari's name or if the Dvati in the middle has some other significance. I've never heard. Anyway, it does appear in the sutra. Also in the Tibetan, it comes that way. He said that in the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara said this to the Venerable Shariputra. Putra. Shariputra. Any son of the lineage or daughter of the lineage who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom should look upon it like this. Yeah, think about it like this. Correctly and repeatedly beholding those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature, empty of inherent existence. So what was alluded to in the previous section where we're saying Avalokiteshvara was contemplating the practice of the perfection of wisdom and looked upon the five aggregates also as empty of inherent existence. Now he's telling, this is what the Shariputra should do. And he said, any son of the lineage or daughter of the lineage. So when it's saying lineage here, what it means is Mahayana lineage. You might think, you know, the Brahmins and other people that felt that their lineage, their family heritage or whatever was important, you know, they say, oh, the Clarks, any Clark would always do this, or any Maclis would always do this, or, you know, kind of the lineage. Here is talking about the Mahayana lineage. So son of the lineage or daughter of the lineage is referring to someone who is awakened in their continuum, what's called the Mahayana lineage. What does that mean? Do you know what that means? Anyone know? Having to awaken the Mahayana lineage? It doesn't mean having developed bodhicitta yet. Just to awaken the Mahayana lineage means to have developed great compassion, which comes before bodhicitta, right? Bodhicitta is great compassion is an essential element in bodhicitta, but great compassion can be developed first, and out of that, contemplating for a long time as to what the best way to alleviate the suffering of sentient beings, one would come to the decision that I must achieve enlightenment. That would be called bodhicitta. So great compassion can come first. Simply developing effortless great compassion is said to be the awakening of the Mahayana lineage in an individual. Before that, they might be of no definite lineage. You know, we talk about lineage of the hearers, solitary realizers, and bodhisattvas. Bodhisattva lineage is a Mahayana lineage. So there might be some people who have, for many, many lifetimes, had some circumstances and teachings that awoken in them the hearer's lineage. I must get out of samsara by meditating on the Four Noble Truths. The Pratika Buddhas would, that lineage, someone like that would have had a greater aspiration, even if it took longer. I must achieve nirvana by meditating on the 12 links of dependent origination. Usually that's the main object of meditation of the Pratika Buddhas. They have sharper intellect. They may take longer to achieve their nirvana, but when they do, they have greater powers. They become what are called Pratika Buddhas, not actual Buddhas, but they, in their final life, they realize their nirvana without the appearance of a Buddha in the world. Solitary realizers is called, like certain kinds of rhinoceri. Forgot what I was saying. Shariputra, any son of the lineage or daughter of the lineage who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom should look upon it like this, correctly and repeatedly beholding those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. So I think correctly and repeatedly have importance here. Correctly means having used proper reasoning and realized the emptiness of inherent existence correctly, perfectly, and repeatedly means meditating on that again and again. It's not as though you just meditate on emptiness once and then you can, you know, anything goes. You know, that's enough. You have to meditate on it again and again, because realizing emptiness directly, first of all, you eliminate certain of the affliction, certain of the klesha, certain of the delusions. You have what's called a cessation of them, true cessation. True cessations, like in the Four Noble Truths, true cessations are states in which a klesha, has been ceased from the root, so it will never come back again. You haven't just subdued it, you know. You've done your Vajrasattva retreat for 3 years, and you feel, you know, I'm never going to get angry again, something like that. But you still have the imprint of that, and it will rise again. You've eliminated them from the instincts, from the roots, from the seeds of those. So you have to do that repeatedly to eliminate finer and finer levels of those klesha, of those afflictions, those delusions. At first, you can get rid of the rough ones with the least, you know, just beginning realization of emptiness. But as your understanding of emptiness increases and you repeatedly do that, you start eliminating the deeper and deeper levels, like cleaning out the roasting pan of the chicken on Thanksgiving. I hope none of you are going to have a lot of family over. If you do, be careful. But, you know, afterwards, you know, you empty out the gross parts of the chicken, and then you get your rubber glove on and you take out the gross stuff. Then you use some plastic thing to clean out some of the stuff that's stuck, and then you use a finer powder to get out more finely clean water. There are different stages in cleaning the pan, right? Like that, to get out all of the obstructions from the mind, you start from the gross. You can't get down to the fine things at the beginning, right? The most subtle stains are obscured by the grosser gunk in the pot. So you have to get rid of those first. Every time you get rid of something gross, you can go a little bit deeper. And as you do so, also your wisdom is becoming more penetrating and is able to get down to those subtler things. So you have to correctly and repeatedly behold those five aggregates also as empty of inherent existence. And as the main subject will begin tomorrow, I'll just repeat here. I'll just say here, form is empty. Emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form. Form is also not other than emptiness. Famous sometimes in some of the English translations of the commentaries, they call the fourfold profundity. Form is empty. Sometimes some of the sutras say form is emptiness, but the reason we say here, form is empty, emptiness is form. Form is not other than emptiness. Emptiness is not other than form. We'll talk about that next time. So let me just read a little bit more of the Tibetan. So I finished before. The Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara said this to the Sariputra. Rikibu, Rikibuam. What is that? Sharipu. Rikibuam, Rikibumo means any son of the lineage or daughter of the lineage. Rikibuam, Rikibumo. Kanglala, any. Sharab ki paru tu chimpa sabmo chopa chepa dupate, that desires to, you know, practice this profound perfection of wisdom. Dike ditar nampar tower ja. They should think about it. They should view like this. Pumpo ngapo dera kyang. Those five aggregates also. Rang shingi tongpa. Nampa yangdakpa jesu tao, they should repeatedly and perfectly and repeatedly contemplate that those five aggregates also are empty of inherent existence. And then the famous fourfold profundity. Suktongbao, tongpani sukso. Suktongbao means form is empty. Tongpani sukso, emptiness is form. Sukle tongpani shen mayin, tongpani le kyang, sukshen mayino. So form is not other than emptiness. Emptiness is not other than form. So we'll go into a little bit of detail of that next time. We're close to 9. but I know some of you might have questions. So if anyone is going to leave, let's just do a very short dedication. And then if you want to leave, leave. And if you want to ask some questions, I will stay a little bit longer. So sit comfortably again and recognize that due to the motivation at the beginning, we've definitely created some virtuous karma tonight. We've been thinking about one of the most profound subjects, the correct understanding of emptiness, of inherent existence, and its presentation in this essence of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. Just that alone has created incredible imprints in our mind stream, virtuous karma. In whatever way these karmic seeds that we've created today, this evening, whatever way they ripen, may they be the cause of my continued understanding of the Buddhist path, developing realizations, expanding my horizons of responsibility for other sentient beings, developing great compassion up to and including my achievement of enlightenment. Due to these merits, may I quickly become fully enlightened Buddha, the state of which, from that state, I can effortlessly and spontaneously lead all sentient beings out of samsara, out of suffering, into that very same state of enlightenment. Recall that the merits themselves are empty of inherent existence because they're amongst phenomena. All phenomena are empty of inherent existence. The goals dedicated to the progression along the path and the ultimate aim of enlightenment, they're empty of inherent existence. And the act of dedication, also process, is empty of inherent existence. Okay, thank you. So anyone who wants to stay, I will stay as long as someone has a question, and or maybe you don't have any questions, in which case you can just catch Rachel. I'm joking.
I have one.
Yes. Naga?
Yes.
Yes.
I feel like there's, although I don't mind, I love being in the class and learning, but then I have the aversions when I go to meet people and the conversations. So I feel like it's a conflict. It conflicts with the helping everyone, you know. You prepare and then, but then you see the people and they already act as if it's not a beginner mind. You don't see the beginner mind of people. They already know things, or they already know it.
They think they do, yeah.
Not help everybody in that way.
Yeah, so that's a good understanding, because that is what the Bodhisattva, the proto-Bodhisattva, person who wants to become a Bodhisattva, actually has to think about. Right now, you know, there are a lot of people, even though I'd like to help them, I can't help. Their minds are so, you know, solid, sort of like concrete. They've decided something is a certain way. Maybe higher bodhisattvas who have clairvoyance, understanding how their thinking could lead them. But even those bodhisattvas will reach a wall also. They feel the same way. Like even Avalokiteshvara, when we talk about the Buddha of compassion, Avalokiteshvara, when he was on the Bodhisattva path, he would, you know, try in one day he would liberate, or you know, leave the seeds of liberation in the minds of so many people. But then he would cry because there were so many people that he had not yet been able to affect, and those tears formed a little, you know the story, formed a little pond from which Aryatara came and offered him assistance. So, even though recalcitrant sentient beings, implacable sentient beings, in order to really lead them out of suffering into enlightenment, we need to be a Buddha. So the frustration you're feeling is good. You utilize that. You say, I can't do anything. I can't really help that much now. I need to have deeper understanding. And that can enhance your wish to achieve enlightenment eventually for the sake of all sentient beings. Because as an ordinary being, it's difficult. Okay.
Do I have to continue being with the people that I keep getting disturbed in my mind?
Well, you know, different times, like in the teachings of the Bodhisattva, when your mind is strong, you can be even with beings of bad character who are, like in the 8 verses of Training the Mind, who are experiencing great suffering and obsessed with negative actions, and they give you a chance to practice patience. But until the point where you can imagine that, you have to sort of train in your meditation cushion. Imagine meeting the people that you can't really spend time with now. You know, they might seem like, oh, if I spend time, I just get depressed and I can't say anything to them that's meaningful. So imagine as yourself evolving in your meditation cushion, having the patience to be there. And by your humble and kind behavior, leaving an imprint in their mind that in the future when you meet them, there will be some opening in their heart that they will listen to what you say. Even right now, you know, like in the 7th verse, it says, I will practice directly and indirectly to bring about all happiness and benefit to all sentient beings, secretly taking on their sufferings and negative actions. So directly and indirectly means you do what you can now. There may be some people that you can affect right now, but those that you cannot affect right now, cannot bring about a change in their minds beneficially, you behave in such a way to them with respect and kindness and patience and love, praying that when you meet them again, you'll be able to give them the nectar of the Dharma, like the five, the five cannibals who came to the Bodhisattva, who was going to eventually become Shakyamuni. They wanted to eat his flesh, you know, when he was a prince. And he said, okay, I'll give you my body, but you have to make a vow that you will not eat meat, you will not eat human flesh on full moon and new moon days. So he created some karmic connection with them, something that with the idea of them getting to eat him, they were willing to do. And he made a promise that by giving my flesh now, he made a prayer, may I be able to feed them the nectar of the Dharma in the future. Those five cannibals, after many, many, you know, lifetimes, I don't remember if it stated exactly when in the past, but in the future, they became the five companions that he meditated with for 6 years, and then they left him, and then they were the five disciples he first taught. They were the disciples he taught the Four Noble Truths to. So he was able to give them the nectar of the Dharma because of many situations like that. When he met them in the past, he prayed that in the future might he be able to give them the nectar of the Dharma. So with that kind of, you know, directly and indirectly, you do what you can directly now, immediately in this lifetime, those that you cannot, there's some karmic obstacle, you don't have enough ability, their minds are too, you know, concrete, whatever, you make prayers to be able to help them in the future, and you leave some good imprints. You'd be patient and kind and, you know, act in a beautiful way toward them, not letting them take advantage of you. I don't mean that, but, you know, you act in a way that leaves some imprint in their mind of receptivity. So in a future lifetime, things will be different. Okay. Anyone else has something? Karen.
Yeah. So as far as the emptiness thing goes, I've been like really trying to understand this, and I just can't quite get there. So I hope I say this right in a way that makes sense. So when I look at the emptiness of a physical object, not the emptiness of self yet, but the emptiness of a physical object. When
like
I did
John as Prius.
Yeah. Like, and when I did it, I was sitting on the beach looking at a ship out there. And I was thinking, you know, like if the ship washed ashore and I took all the parts and made them into a hotel, would it still be a ship or would it be a hotel?
Oh.
Right. And so I was thinking about all this and like, and it really hit me then, where is the ship? Well, the ship is here. You know, the ship is a concept in my mind. And then there's, like you said, the metal, the wood, the glass, the physical pieces are really not the ship, right? So right. I kind of got that far. But then when I go to try to apply that to myself, so I've got this idea, I've got that there's a physical thing, but then the ship is a concept, and that's why we don't necessarily agree on what a ship is, because we all have a different idea in our head.
Well, generally, most people would say that's a ship.
Right.
Unless they have a different language or they never encountered it. So if the parts were taken apart and made into a hotel, that configuration is no longer called a ship, unless the bow was there and the mermaid at the, you know, whatever, you know.
Right.
And so, oh, that's a ship hotel, you know, but that's different. So generally, the parts have to be arranged in a certain way that are recognized, and we call that a ship because it floats on the water and so forth. In the same way, your parts, your aggregates, your form aggregate, and your other, you know, the five mental parts, that the four mental parts, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and primary consciousness, they are the basis upon which you can label, how do you pronounce your name? Is it, do you say Karen also?
Karen.
Okay, because it's Karen's with an I, and you're a Karen with an E.
Oh, Karen.
Yeah. So we label, when we see you, we label this person, we say, there's Karen. We say, where's Karen? Oh, she's in North Carolina. I assume you're in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
You're on Zoom. I don't know. You're where? Oh, she's in Raleigh. Where? In her home. Where? In that room. And then you walk in and say, where's Karen? I say, that's Karen. But if you try to, that's legitimate. That's what's called conventional analysis. Mm-hmm. But if you search and you're not satisfied with that, and so, okay, well, what's Karen? Is it her nose? Like the, remember the Prius or the Mercedes-Benz, like the medallion? What's the real Mercedes? What's the real essence of Karen? Is it her mind or her body or her skin or her hair or whatever? You can't find anything in those parts when you analyze.
Right. Right.
And you realize that Karen is not other than those parts. You can come up with the understanding that Karen, that you had believed was findable in the parts, doesn't exist. But Karen, without analysis, without that kind of what's called ultimate analysis, just saying, oh, that's Karen, that's okay. Just leaving it at that. That Karen exists conventionally.
Mm-hmm.
But that Karen, even that conventional Karen, if you try to analyze within its parts, where is the Karen? Or where is Karen? You can't find. That's called ultimate analysis, and you realized you realize then that the search for that inherently existent Karen is futile, that it doesn't exist at all. But that doesn't negate the conventional existence of Karen. That Karen, you know, that's ship, that's Karen.
Yeah, I mean, so my question I'm trying to get to is that I'm thinking I'm thinking of ship as being a concept that we have about these objects. And so when I try to make an analogy to the self, I'm just saying my self, the me, is just a conglomeration of ideas that I have, just thoughts, ideas. And other people also have ideas and thoughts about what Karen is, and I have thoughts and ideas about what Karen is. But it's not the body. I can get that much. But right. It seems to me that those thoughts and ideas do exist in my consciousness, in my mind. They do. The thoughts are there.
Yeah, those concepts and thoughts are there, but those are not what are called the object that is being negated in emptiness.
Yeah, so I think I don't have the right object. I'm thinking.
So that's the thing. Like, for instance, there was a great Hindu Hindu saint who maybe some of you know, who lived maybe, I think he died maybe 20 years ago. He used to live near a mountain in South India, and people would come sometimes for instruction. And his method was, he would say, "Who are you?"
Yes.
And they go, "I'm a doctor." And he's, and they said, no. And then, "Who are you?" And then, "Okay, well, I'm a man." "Well, who are you?" And then they would go through all of these different ideas of who they were. But finally, when confronted, realizing that's not the real essence, the subtle concept of yourself as having some kind of real findable existence, like what in Christianity is called the soul. You know, there was some famous Catholic theologian, I'm not sure, Thomas Aquinas or someone, who said, there's no need to prove the existence of the soul because it's so obvious. That's the object of negation. You know, the sense of some identity existing there always. And even then, it takes a long time to recognize what is actually being negated when you talk about personal selflessness. That self is something that appears to your mind. If someone says, "Karen, you're a jerk."
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like at that point you think your body is a jerk, mm-hmm. or you might think your mind is a jerk. If someone says, "You're a thief," and you're not, and you're indignant, you know, "I've never stolen anything." It's when you say, "I've never stolen anything," that sense of "I" that is deep in your mind, a sense of I-ness, me-ness, selfness, that's the object. Sometimes it has to be instigated a little bit. It's said that when you're trying to find the object of negation here, of the self, you think of some situation when you've been unjustly criticized, some sharp words, and you know, "What do you mean?" Or the passion of attachment, you know, "I love you," or "I," you know, this or that. Very strong sense of "I" is not something that is identifying with the body, not identifying with the mind, but seems to be something hovering there independently. That's the subtle object of negation of selflessness. And it's not some, because it, the whole concept of emptiness and selflessness is difficult to understand. It's said that really one has to be very careful and not jump to conclusions. If misunderstood emptiness, you know, if you misunderstand emptiness, what it means, and you progress, you try to practice on the basis of some misapprehension, you can be harmed. Your spiritual practice can be harmed. You might think that emptiness means there's no self whatsoever. So I'll just walk across the street in the middle of traffic. I don't exist or something like that. Or you might have other misconceptions. It's said that like a snake, if you're not skilled in how to handle a snake and you just try to pick it up in the middle, the snake and head can come over and bite you and the venom can kill you and so forth. So like that, you need to have skill, having received instructions that gradually bring you to an understanding of emptiness. Don't fret that you don't get it, this emptiness thing you said at the beginning. I like this emptiness thing. It takes time because it is something very, very subtle. As I said on other occasions, bodhicitta and compassion is something we think, oh, that I can understand. But it's actually very, very difficult to actualize bodhicitta. You can, even though it's easy to explain and conceptually understand. On the other hand, emptiness is something that's difficult to understand conceptually. But once you patiently think about it and hear about it, maybe over a couple of lifetimes even, leave imprints, once you understand it correctly, it can be realized, at least intellectually, first of all, and eventually in more profound ways, more quickly. So it's said that the bodhisattvas, people who want to develop bodhicitta, those of sharp intellect first realize emptiness. They have an insight into emptiness. Mm-hmm. They realize, hi, Karen, the Karen I've always thought existed doesn't really exist. I could be thinking of me, meaning all sentient beings, like Shanti Deva says in the Bodhisattva Charvatar. I could impute I onto the entirety. That's just as legitimate. And therefore, one could develop bodhicitta more rapidly. It said that two general characters, categories of bodhisattvas, those of sharp intellect and those of weak intellect, or sharp faculties. The main faculty here is talking about wisdom. There are other faculties like memory, mindfulness and other things, and concentration. And those who are, they're sharp and lesser faculties. The ones of sharp faculty can understand emptiness first and then develop bodhicitta very, very rapidly. So I kind of think we are in a position in the United States, many of us are kind of in that category of sharp faculties. Even though we don't understand it yet, this emptiness thing, if you have patience and realize it's something that is conceptually difficult to understand, once you understand it correctly, due to your patience and your perseverance, you can make rapid progress. So don't give up.
I'm not giving up. Okay. I'm not giving up. I'm just, I'm still stuck on this idea, like with the thief. The thing that's offended is my idea that I'm an honest person, right? So this is this concept of honesty that seems offended. It's a concept.
If I was that Hindu teacher, I would say, who are you again? So that, let go of that one. There's something more subtle there. It's not talking about your concept of honesty. It's talking about recognizing what appears to your mind when I say, Karen, you're a thief. There's a sense of I. It's what's the initial response. You know, I said, the teacher said, who are you? He said, oh, I'm an architect. No. Who are you? Oh, I'm a man. Oh, no, who are you? I'm this. All sorts of ideas. None of those are the object of negation. We're not negating that you're conventionally an honest person or anything else. It's to try to instigate the subtle appearance of a object that we've believed since beginningless time That is to say, obviously in previous life you weren't called necessarily Karen. You might have been called Karen sometime. It doesn't mean that. It means I. Even when we were a bug, or we were a hell being, or we were a long life God, there was a sense of I.
Mm-hmm.
And that sense of I, it seems to be, in the subtle most form of it, seems to be something independent of the body and mind, inherently existent. That means, as Chandrakirti says in the Majjhimagavata, or in his commentary to Aryadeva, that sense of I is one which is not dependent on other.
Right.
It's independent of anything else. Inherently existent. That's the one that's so hard to recognize. So it's not the sense of the concepts that come up, you say, oh, I'm not a thief, I'm honest. That's not the point. It's try to see the I that's instigating that is brought up, made more clear in a dynamic situation like that. Like, for instance, there's a practice called called severance or cutting off. It's where the yogi or yogini would go to a charnel ground, cemetery at night, spooky place, and they would invite the spirits to eat their body, to eat their flesh and blood and their bones and all the different combinations thereof. There's a white offering, red offering. And in so doing, the object of negation of selflessness would appear, you know, when you get really scared, you say, the I can sort of become clear for a while. Right now, in our ordinary situation, we don't notice that subtle appearance of the I. It's something that needs either great concentration and analysis. That's why try to develop concentration and wisdom to recognize it. And that can be aided by some kind of instigation. You know, so when bad things happen to good people, so we say Karen is a good person, she's an honest person, she tells us. So when bad things happen, you should think, oh, this is a chance I can see the eye. This is good.
Yeah.
The lojong, you know, when bad things happen, how to bring those into the path. We're going to have lots of failures from now until the end of our samsara. So if we can utilize one of them and say, oh, thanks for criticizing me, you know.
Yeah, I have heard that. Try to do that. But I just can't get, I'm going to let it go now because I'm having a hard time getting past this. Maybe I just need more time to contemplate it. But it just keeps seeming to me like it's this conglomeration of ideas that's the problem, that the ideas about myself are the problem. So
that's not the problem. That's what
that's not the problem.
That's not the problem. Those are symptoms of the problem.
Okay.
The problem is something that is, they're kind of like this. I can't see you right now. Can you see me?
No.
Maybe you could see me because my head was in a different place. But because those problems are there, those problematic states of mind, you can't see the I that's causing them.
Okay.
So you have to get down to that. Anyway, we'll leave it at that.
Yep.
Anyone else have before we go? Pati, did you have something? No. Okay. So we will leave it here, and we'll continue tomorrow on the fourfold profundity. Form is empty. Emptiness is form. Form is not other than emptiness. Emptiness is not other than form. Have a good night. Thank you.
Thank you, Venerable George.
Thank you all. Bye, Donna. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Have a good night.
You too. Bye now.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Venerable George.